Dr. Swinyard, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I'm assuming you're joining us from Spokane. Is that your office?
It is, yeah. Yep, this is our central office, which is in the downtown core of the Spokane area.
So tell me a little bit about Spokane Public Schools and about your students. What makes you special?
Yeah, well, you know, Spokane's an incredible community in eastern Washington. It's the largest city east of the Cascade Mountains in our state. And Spokane, we're a school district of approximately 30,000 students, 57 schools, and around 6,000 employees. So lots of things to be proud of in our community, a lot of pride in our school district, and a lot of great work happening on creating access and opportunity for every kid.
Tell me something you're proud of.
Yeah, well, I'm really proud of our graduation rate, and we've had some pretty tremendous gains in the last 10 years in Spokane Public Schools. We've had some student groups that have really achieved some great strides. For example, our Native students have increased their grad rate by over 20% in the last 4 years. And something we believe really deeply in is building strong partnerships with our families and having really great two-way communication. Last spring, we did a survey. We had almost 11,000 families fill out a survey. I am thrilled when like one person fills out a survey. And so we had about 11,000 of our 30,000 families. 80% of them said they highly recommend their student school. And when asked about overall quality, the average was a 4 out of 5. And so we are so proud of the parental sentiment about our school district. We think that that speaks volumes about the experience that kids are having every day in our schools and the work that we're doing to connect parents and caregivers to their students' school life.
Okay, I have to dig in on a couple of things. So when we hosted the CEO of Digital Promise, one of the things he said was that the missing leg of the stool is often parents, that, you know, schools and companies like mine are not doing enough to engage parents. So kudos to you for having that. But let me tell you something else that I've heard recently is that 80% of parents say that they love their child's school, but that a similar percentage also says that American education is failing. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's to be anticipated in that, you know, people have really positive perceptions when there's proximity to the experience and the relationship. And so they feel really great. They love their student's teacher. But they feel like maybe a national trend or a national narrative maybe is disconnected from what actually happens to them on a daily basis. And so I think it's just that much more important that we're having, you know, local conversations with our families about our school systems. But I also think it's important that there's a robust national dialogue around how American public education is performing, and to address some of the misnomers that have metastasized over the last decade about what happens inside of our schools across the country. Certainly, there's always room to do better, but there's also, I believe, a lot to be proud of public education in our country. I think it's the foundation and cornerstone of our society. It has served us well for quite some time, and will continue to serve us well, and it will continue to be the great equalizer, despite the extent to which there's movements to sort kids who have different levels of access and opportunity.
Okay, so tell me this, what's a narrative that you think is spread around our country that's maybe not accurate? And where's an area that we could do better as a country, not just in Spokane?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, test scores are something that what I'm seeing more and more, lots of conversations about test scores, and predominantly those are predicated about around one point in time proficiency measures. And so one of the analogies that I ask people, and I'm someone that I really believe in discourse, and I really love and respect the diversity of thought that is in our community, in our country. I think that makes us better and stronger. And so when I'm in those spaces and having those conversations, I like to approach them with an inquiry mindset rather than trying to convince somebody of my perspective. I think it's important to introduce ideas and ask people what they think about them. And an example of that is if we're talking about fourth grade test scores, and you're a fourth grade teacher, and every student in your class walks through the door at the start of the year at the beginning of fourth grade level, And at the end of the year, every student in your class passes the test. That's great. Every kid in your class came in at the start of fourth grade. They all passed the fourth grade assessment. 100% of your kids pass. You are the best teacher on the planet. There should be lots of throwing of roses and celebrations, and we love our teacher. Across town, fourth grade teacher, every single one of their students walks in at the first grade level. And at the end of the year, they end the year at the third grade level. Sadly, every single one of them failed the state assessment for the fourth grade proficiency exam. 0% of those kids passed. What the national narrative is this teacher over here is great, and this teacher over here is terrible, and we should fire them. When in reality, these kids over here, they grew 2 years. I think 2 years growth is amazing, and we should celebrate those kids and those teachers. And so I do think the way in which we assess performance, the way in which we talk about whether or not we're meeting our obligation to our parents and to our communities, I'm not sure we're doing that in a valid and reliable way. And I don't think it's grounded in growth and really talking about where were they on day one to day 180. If you're a community like ours, we have around 30% of our kids come in kindergarten ready. And so that's a 70% of our kids, are starting from behind. And yet we're defining success on whether or not they're all proficient in a one point in time test. I also wonder for people, where else in our economy do we say May 14th, we're going to decide if you're a good podcast host. And if you have a good podcast on May 14th, you get to keep your job. And if you have a bad day, you're fired. It doesn't matter what went on in your life the night before. It doesn't matter if your house burned down. It doesn't matter if you lost a relative. It doesn't matter if you had breakfast. It's really all about May 14th. We don't do that anywhere else in our economy. We don't judge and evaluate performance really anywhere else like that. We use a collection and a body of evidence to determine whether or not there's growth and progress and success. And so I am troubled that we are continuing to fixate on a national discourse around a very draconian methodology for how we assess student performance and success in our schools. And there's really great technology emerging around adaptive assessments. We've had adaptive assessments for quite some time. They're only getting better. And yet we continue to fixate on a one point in time proficiency test.
I really appreciate the story you just told. I think for so many teachers, it feels so real. As someone who at one point was a school leader in the number one school in Colorado, and at another point was a kindergarten teacher in the lowest rated school in Denver Public Schools, that narrative is all too real for me. And I think that it really means a lot to a lot of people that you can kind of see exactly how this plays out in the classroom, that one day in time decides who your students are and who you are as a teacher. And I think that that's true. I do have to point out, though, that I asked you for one way that our narrative is positive, where could we be doing something, that people don't really hear the great story. So tell me a great story, something that is really inspiring you that maybe isn't being told on the national stage.
Yeah, well, I think, over time, when you look at the last 100 years in public education, you see this really steady evolution of the roles that our schools have played. We've come a long ways from the one rural school, room schoolhouse where we're teaching literacy and math. And, in the 50s, school meals and counseling, those were pretty progressive, innovative ideas. Those are things that are just, we just expect those now. Like a school without meals, a school without a counselor, who would ever do that? And so I do think, and I think educators and I think our country should be really proud how our public education system continually steps up to meet the needs of the moment. And I think you see that post-pandemic where schools are working to step up and meet the needs. And the scope of the work and the provision of services we provide are something that I think we should all be really proud of. In Spokane, we really believe that our schools are the hubs of our neighborhoods. They're a hub for learning, they're a hub for relationships, and they're a hub for access to resources and support, because every kid deserves the opportunity to be happy and successful. And I'm somebody that really believes deeply in the dream of public education. And we've not fully realized that dream, but every kid deserves the opportunity to pursue it. And So I think there's a lot to be proud of how schools just continue to evolve, continue to respond. We have almost 50 mental health therapists that are embedded inside of our schools in Spokane. a decade ago, that would have been hard to wrap your mind around. And yet we continue to evolve to meet the moment.
I love that you see that as a positive, because I think for a lot of people, it's like, oh my God, the schools are doing too much. And I feel like for you, it's like, we're doing exactly what our kids need. And so is it a lot? Sure. But it's exactly what our kids need. I also love that you brought up school meals. I just read an article in the New York Times that kids went to bat for their French toast sticks. Did you hear this story? They protested getting rid of the French toast sticks. I thought that seemed really like a great moment for kids to kind of let us know what they need. I thought that made me laugh. One of the things that you mentioned really quickly, and I want to kind of dial into, is you said 20, I think you've seen a 20% increase in graduation rate for your native student population. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So where did you start? Where are you now as far as that 20% increase, and how did you do it?
Yeah, well, I think that, really trying to be mindful of and connected to the needs of our community and to the needs of our students. And I think one of the ways we have maybe lost our way a little bit is we always show up in spaces with the answer, and we tell people what their problems are and then how to solve them. And I think something that we have really tried to be mindful of is showing up in spaces and saying, how can we partner with you in loving your student and loving your child and helping them be successful? And we're here to learn from you. And I think a lot of really beautiful things have come from that in our school district. Whether that's Sense Time and Memorial curriculum and making sure that there are mirrors, doors, and windows in our school district. There's mirrors so that kids can see themselves and the adults they work with and can see themselves in the curriculum. There's windows so that they can see out into the world. And then there's doors where members of the community can come in and be a partner. And we've done that through mentoring, we've done it through curriculum, we've done it through after school clubs. And it's really been predicated around that philosophy of, does every kid feel like there's mirror doors and windows in their school experience? And do they see their community a part of the school district?
I feel like in everything I ask you, you bring up the community around your kids, and that this is like, is that your vision for Spokane? Is that your vision for all schools? Is that it's not just about the kids, but it's about everybody who touches the lives of children?
Well, I think in lots of ways, and we could probably talk for hours on how we have kind of found ourselves in this point. But I do think that American public education does need to center itself on the understanding that the school district belongs to the community. And we are their employees, and they hire us to provide a service to them. And when I'm in staff meetings, I regularly talk about that with staff and just saying, I'm an employee. Everybody in this room, we are employees. They have hired us to do a job. And so we should be keenly seeking to understand how they want us to do that job, because we belong to them and we are their employees. And by the nature of that very relationship, we should be astutely connected to what their definition of success looks like and what their definition of support looks like. And I think the more that we've brought community into those tables, the more that we have not only come up with good ideas, but also helped establish trust and a line of communication that helps us navigate through the good days and the bad days.
As a mother and someone who like works in my own school district or spends time with my own school district, I really appreciate and value that. But I've also heard the other side, as someone who talks to superintendents on a weekly basis, that parents are often very upset and they want to protect their children. They, you know, where they come from is a love for their child, but what they want is probably not a solution for all children, or is not even, you know, a solution at all. And I'm just curious, like when you get into that situation where this community that you think of as your employer is less than productive in what they want, how do you manage that?
Well, I think when we are making decisions or developing a standard of practice based on individuals and individual incidences or individual conversations, I think you can quickly lose your way. And something I said to a group last night is almost every question I ask myself is, and we all need each other. Whatever the question is, budget, and we all need each other. to show up and be part of the conversation? What should we do about cell phones? And we all need each other to show up and be part of the conversation. What should we do around this curriculum? And we all need each other to show up and be a part of the conversation. And so what I suggest is not that we are wildly yielding left and right to the demands of an individual parent in an individual circumstance. It's we're setting up spaces to have community conversations around what do we want our children's school experience to look like? And how do we make sure that all parts of our community feel like they're included in that conversation, not just one economic class or one particular racial group? How do we create spaces to have a community level conversation? I also think that you can have amazing customer service and not always say yes. Like we see that in business and industry. Like you can go into a store and try to return something and they can treat you horribly and say no, but you can also go into a store and try to return something and have them say no and they can treat you wonderfully. And how you feel and the relationship and connection you have to that no experience makes a world of difference. And we talk about that regularly with our leaders is what's the no experience like? How do you navigate no? And I don't think we think about that enough. What does no look like? What does it sound like? And do you allow people to keep their dignity? Do you allow people to feel heard? Do you allow people to have their point recognized? Because yeah, you might know going into this conversation, it's gonna be no. No, I'm not gonna change your grade from a D to an A. That's not happening. But how we do that and the way in which we do it, that can be built on love. And you know, we talk about that, that we're a district built on love and it's the most transformational force on earth. It transcends every human emotion. And it doesn't mean there isn't gonna be arguments or disagreements or conflict. It means that how we show up in spaces and how we treat each other, that ultimately ends up creating the connective tissue that's gonna make us strong in the long run.
I have to tell you the example I thought of. So I have 4-year-old twins and I recently took them to Disneyland. And Disneyland, you actually hear no a ton, right? Like, no, you cannot sit with Winnie the Pooh all day long, but they do it in the most loving way. Winnie the Pooh is so happy to meet you. It was the best time of his life, but now it's time for you to go on a ride. Like they tell you no in the nicest way. And like, it's crazy. I feel like we should all go through whatever that training is as far as saying no with love. And I'm going to take that from this. I'm going to remember of like, how am I saying no is a really good question. I'll probably never be as good as Mary Poppins, but I'll work on it.
Yeah. Well, I have a teenage daughter and you know, how you say no in love. I'm finding I'm saying no at a fairly high rate these days. And I'm learning just like as a toddler, like the way in which you say no can be escalatory. And with a teenage daughter, the way in which you say no can be escalatory. And I think those are just good examples of, you know, that's not just about being a parent. That's how we are navigating each other across lots of landscapes.
That's really great. Let me ask you though, you said that you like you love having your community and you like listening to the voices. You're an employee. What's a time where you went to the table with your community and you changed your mind? So not a time that you said no with love, but a time that you thought you were going to say no or thought you were going to say one thing and you changed your mind based on the community voices.
You know, I can't think of a circumstance where maybe I changed my mind, but I definitely can think of circumstances where my my feelings evolved and I learned a lot from hearing the perspective of a parent or the perspective of a community advocate. And it's helped me see things differently. And we are predominantly a product of our lived experience. And I think the more that we can be open to that reality and to really try to listen intently to the experiences of others and help that inform how we might do things differently. I think that's really important for a superintendent in labor relations that, you know, as a superintendent, I'm considering a lot of really complicated factors. And when I'm listening to our labor partners, they're bringing forward a voice from people that are doing the work in classrooms every single day. And, you know, at first blush, it feels like it's very easy to sometimes say, well, you know, come on. And so I've learned to really ask a lot of questions and to really try to unpack you know, the art of listening, which is, feels like it's, can be hard to do in this day and age.
I fully hear that. I think when I hear, and what I'm sure in your community they love about you is that you are just a really deep listener. But you also seem to be somebody who kind of like shows up to the challenge. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. When I was reading your bio and getting ready for this interview, and we were doing, you have like these awards, you have all these accolades, but the part that like stood out to me was you took this job in summer of 2020. And I know exactly what, I was a school principal at the time. I know exactly what summer of 2020 looked like. And I don't think I would have ever thought, you know what I think I want to go do is lead a school district. Tell me a little bit about that decision, that timing, and your plans when you were coming in like mid-pandemic, not even mid-pandemic, like mid-peak pandemic in Spokane.
Yeah, I would like to believe that I'm put together like every other teacher. That, you know, as teachers, we meet the moment. You know, when we have a kid that has a need, you figure it out. You don't understand that diagnosis, you learn about it, you figure it out. Somebody doesn't have shoes, you figure it out. And so I don't think there's anything special about my journey. I think I'm built like a teacher, and we figure it out. And so, you know, when I was a principal, there's things you don't know, there's challenge, and you figure it out. And that's how I approach the superintendency. It's, you know, I was 36 and getting ready to turn 37. And it was the middle of a, you know, global pandemic with lots of supercharged challenges and emotions. And you just make one good decision at a time and give grace to yourself and to others, and try to be a thoughtful, relational, and consistent communicator. And you know, those things served us really well. We have an awesome team in Spokane, a great group of leaders, a great group of staff, great union leadership, and lots of obviously hard conversations, intense moments. But you know, that adage of just putting one foot in front of the other, it's very true. And also that the adage that this too shall pass, and it can be really easy to get tangled up in moments. And what I've learned is, you know, to keep looking to the horizon and stay consistent to your values, and this too shall pass. And, you know, hard moments will pass, and you navigate it through, and you try to do the best you can and make the best decision. And then you just keep going, and you just keep going, and you just keep going, and you just keep going. And like I said, I think that's what we do as teachers. And I've tried to carry that into the superintendency.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. I think most people would say that 36 seems like somewhat of a young superintendent. Do you at all like regret?
I feel old. Let me tell you, I feel old.
Okay. Tell me one of the most important lessons you've learned since becoming a superintendent.
I think I'll answer it very, very specific to the role of being a superintendent. And that from my perspective, and what I've learned is the job of a superintendent is to communicate and build coalitions. And so every day I wake up and I think about, who do I need to communicate with today? Whether that's broadly or very personally, and how am I helping to grow and strengthen the coalition of support for Spokane Public Schools? And that's my lens every day is how am I doing those two things? And I know if I do those two things, then I am going to help support the central office leaders who are going to help support the principals, who are going to help support the teachers, who are going to help support students and families. And so I probably went through some iterations of just trying to wrap my mind, like, what is this job? Like, this is crazy. And it's very different. You know, I went to school to be a teacher and a coach. Like, that was my jam. Like, that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I went to school for. Like, I never thought like, oh, I'm going to be a superintendent. Like, I've just, Providence has brought me here. And so there was a period of time of really trying to figure out how to invest your time. And there's just all these ways you can invest your time. There's all these things you can spend your time doing. And for me in my journey, I had to really, you know, center it around, okay, so what's my lens every day? I have this lens that I need to look through my day so that I'm, you know, being as useful as I can to our school district.
So when did that change for you? So you were a teacher and a coach. That was like your heart. I love the way you say it's your jam. I know that feeling too. I saw a friend of mine recently said that she was walking her kid, like walking away from the school after dropping off her kid, and was like, that PE teacher looks really happy. She's like, that is where it's at life. When did the change, when did you change? Like, when did you like think leadership was where you were meant to be?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, pretty early on in teaching. And I think some of it has to do with, you know, having a background in coaching and just, you know, feeling a lot of sense of fulfillment and purpose around supporting other people's success. I became an assistant principal, and I really enjoyed supporting the success of my principal. Like I loved seeing him be successful. And so that the more I got some experiences with that, the more opportunities came along, and I, you know, said yes to them. So it wasn't a part of like this long range plan of this is what I'm going to do. I've really just, you know, tried to be really thoughtful about each opportunity that's come along. And I've been really incredibly blessed to be with the same school district for a while. And, you know, the longer you're with a school district, at least my experience is just the more in love you fall in with it. And I love my district and our families and our kids, and I care about them, and it makes it all worth it.
I don't know if you're getting a little choked up or if it's just that you need water, but I was a little choked up on the teacher moment. So if you're getting a little choked up, I'm there with you, and I appreciate it. And I love how much you love your district. I hope my superintendent loves my district as much as you love yours. That's really lovely. Tell me the biggest difference between being a superintendent and a principal.
I think, at least in my context, scale. I think there's more similarities than there are differences. I think leadership is leadership, and how you build relationships, how you communicate, how you're organized, how you try to approach your work from a systems perspective. I think a lot of that is transferable to the principalship. I'm envious of how much time they get to spend with kids on a daily basis, but I do think a lot of it is transferable. I think as a central office leader, you know, the continuum of topics that you're working on and the amount of time you can invest in any one topic, it felt a lot different than being a principal. When I was a principal, I felt like there was definitely diversity of topics and there was definitely scale. It's just at the central office, it feels like the scope of that is quite a bit different. And so, as we've recruited central office leaders, that's been something that I've tried to be really mindful of, just, you know, trying to help support people in finding a good fit. And if you're somebody that, you know, really likes to be able to put your focus in one or two areas and really move those forward, then, you know, being a building principal can be really fulfilling. If you're somebody that really thrives off a lot of diversity and a lot of diversity of topics and a pace where maybe you're not able to spend a lot of time in one particular thing, but you can manage a lot of work at one time, then maybe that's a better fit. But I always tell people being a principal to me it's infinitely more stressful than being a superintendent.
You know what? It's funny. The superintendent of Orange County in Florida, which is like the eighth largest district in the country, said the hardest job she's ever had was being a K-8 principal. And she still thinks about that a lot when she thinks her superintendent job is hard. So I appreciate you saying that. What's like the hardest lesson you've learned in this job?
When working with humanity, there is going to inevitably be bad days, and there's going to be mistakes, and there's going to be moments of hardship and harm. And it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And as we sit here talking, I know that at any moment my cell phone is going to go off and I'm going to be dealing with a very complex, challenging topic that has potentially harmed one person or many people in one way or other, either physically or emotionally or socially. And so sometimes the gravity of that is hard. That's hard. The other part that comes to mind too is just the magnitude of suffering. You know, there's a lot of suffering, a lot. Families are suffering, kids are suffering, and there isn't one person in this world that can end that suffering. There's a lot we can do to try to move the needle, but you know, it pulls heavy on my heart anytime I walk through an elementary, and I go to two or three schools a day, and it's like I walk through some of our high poverty elementary schools, and the lives that some of those little people are dealing with is the weight of that suffering and the gravity and the scope of that suffering sometimes feels overwhelming. But there's also hope in it too of, you know, it's like when people criticize the role of the school district, and it's like, who else is going to make sure that kid's fed? Who else is going to make sure they're clothed? Who else is going to connect them to counseling services? Like, who else is coming? Like, tell me, who else is coming? Who else is coming to help that kid? Who else is coming to help save them? Because they live in an abusive home, they're in neglect, their house is, you know, completely immersed in feces and garbage, and who else is going to help them? So you can talk to me all day long about school districts and scope of work and this and that. And at the end of the day, who's going to help that 5-year-old? Who's that kid's voice? Who's that kid's aid? Sometimes overwhelming.
No, I'm overwhelmed hearing about it. I have goosebumps. And I have to tell you, like, I've heard the opposite end of this too, which is when someone succeeds in life, like unexpectedly, right? When someone overcomes it all and they ask, like, who helped you get here? How did it happen? It's like overwhelming the percentage of times that it's a teacher. That the person said, this one teacher cared about me. This one teacher said I could sing. This one teacher, you know, so to your point about who, it's been the same person all this time. It's just now we're really recognizing that, you know, schools and districts have been playing this role. It's just now teachers aren't always the ones buying the snacks, that districts can help them help these kids. And so I think you're making a really good point. We got really, you know, deep there for a second. Tell me something that you're really excited to do in, like, let's say the next year in Spokane.
Yeah, well, you know, something that that I think is going to be one of the key focal points of the next 5 to 10 to 15 years is engagement, and the extent in which kids feel engaged, which we know is there's tremendous intersectionality to a sense of belonging and relationship and connection. And you know, I think this the level of disengagement is something that there's been momentum around for quite some time. I don't think masks caused it, but I think they certainly accelerated and exasperated the sense of disengagement that our kids are feeling, and then all the ancillary things that come along with that. And you know, and so we're talking a lot in our school district around, okay, so how do we increase student engagement? And you know, how do we center on that? And obviously, you know, there's offshoots to that of like, well, attendance, how do we prove attendance? Or how do we prove? And really a lot of those questions come back to, well, you know, is the student engaged in school, and do they feel a sense of belonging and connection, and do they want to be there? Because, you know, attendance, court, and all these things, that's probably not the answer. And I don't think we're seeing it to be the answer. And I think also what is unique about the moment is we are competing for the attention of kids from an adversary that is more formidable than we have ever faced. And that's technology. And technology has so many great things about it: access, opportunity, great tools. And I think we do a lot of those in Spokane. But I am extremely worried about the amount of time that kids spend on personal devices and the amount of time that they're on social media. And I really believe in my heart that social media is like ingesting poison. And I think it's analogous to kids in Flint, Michigan, drinking lead in the water and needing a doctor. We've got kids spending 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours a night on social media, and then we're surprised they need a therapist. And so we are really trying to take that head on in Spokane Public Schools. And we're trying to take a strength-based approach. We're trying to take a positive approach to it. The answer is not to tell kids they can't be on Netflix. The answer is not to tell them they can't have their device or be on Snapchat or whatever. Like, that's you know, I think we need to really lean into parent education and make sure that we're doing our part to raise awareness around the risks and the threats and the detrimental social and health determinants of spending time on devices. But what can we do as a school district? And so we're really leaning into every kid every day has something to do after school. Activities, clubs, sports, every kid every day in Spokane Public Schools, we want them to be doing something. And we really think that is the most practical thing we can do, because it's not going to work to say you can't be on a device. But what we can say is, hey, Laura, you know, instead of going home beyond your device for 8 hours, why don't you be involved in chess club or board game club or esports or the soccer team or whatever? And so then maybe you're only on your device for an hour or two a night. You know, it's not going to work to try to hire a therapist for every kid. There's not enough money or people. So what are practical strategies that school districts can do to create a sense of belonging and connection for kids? We know the research is really clear on extracurricular activities and athletics. We know a lot of kids don't come to school for the science textbook. As much as we love science and we want to spark some type of hope and excitement for a career future, they're probably not coming for the textbook. Kids come to school for the socialization, and they come to school to do fun and exciting things. And so American education has got to acclimate itself to that and recenter itself and say, okay, we need to have fun, exciting, productive things for kids to do outside of the school day. As one strategy to increase engagement and a sense of belonging, knowing there are many other pieces to that. But we think that's a practical way to do that. We brought back the elementary spelling bee. People went wild for it. The spelling bee. Like, it's not new. It's not innovative. It's been around for a while. Families got so excited about that. We were, you know, the science fair. We, you know, are talking about, you know, more clubs, more activities. We asked our high school kids, hey, what do you want to do? What are you interested in? I was so surprised. They said, we want to have talent shows. That's what we want to do. We want to have talent shows. It's like, we can do that. I hope I don't have to go, but we can absolutely do talent shows. You know, and so I think that that's something that I'm really excited and passionate about, because I do think that we're going to need some really practical strategies to address the this new reality of personal devices, isolation, social media. We need some practical and positive things to do to confront it.
I feel like someone's going to go through my episode. My producer's going to go through the episode and is going to be like, every 5 minutes you mention something else you are doing for your community, whether it's feeding the kids or making sure they have the health services they need or having after school clubs. And I have to tell you, that's amazing. It reminds me of two things. When I was a kindergarten teacher, I used to ask people all the time what their favorite memory was from kindergarten and then try to incorporate. And it was the weirdest things. Like, I guess the one that I remember doing is at Thanksgiving, someone remembered that they made like a cookbook for their class where like they had to tell how you make Thanksgiving, and they still had theirs. So my class did that. I tried to like create all these memories that other people had, because it wasn't the tests. It wasn't the other things. It was the memories that make school magical. And I think so much of what you're saying makes sense. But I also recently read an article that a mother who was a researcher was talking about her daughter in soccer. And she said, you know, from their own family, but then from other families too, the happiest they had, the best time they had was there with their kid was right after soccer practice. And they think it was the 2 hours away from the device, that for 2 hours she had nothing. And that was the thing that made, and that it was, she was like, they would fight over who would pick their daughter up from soccer because they both wanted to have that happy teenager for a little bit.
And, you know, it's going to be big work, and it's community, collective community impact that's going to get us there. And, you know, as a school district, we can't provide enough activities and athletics and clubs for every kid every day. We have to have partners. Spokane was one of the largest 3-on-3 basketball tournaments in the country. It's a huge source of pride for our community. Thousands of teams in the summer come and play.
I didn't know that.
And you know, we have Gonzaga basketball and we have Hoop that makes us very special. And, you know, coming out of the pandemic, we talked to that organization and just said, hey, we need your help. You know, we need your help getting more kids involved. And through a partnership with them, they run our youth basketball league for us. And we went from 900 kids playing youth basketball to 4,000 in a year and a half window. Huge increase. And it was all centered around reducing barriers, low cost, no cost, putting kids on teams based on their school, you didn't need to know somebody or have a connection or bargain yourself or negotiate yourself onto a team. It was truly a program centered around access. And those kids didn't just wake up one day and decide they wanted to play basketball. They've always wanted to play. And the reason we went from 900 to 4,000 is because we believe in providing experiences, and we believe in partnerships, and we believe in addressing access for kids. And so, you know, I think that's an example of what the future is going to look like for public education. It's going to take partnerships like that to be able to scale opportunities to the level to get all kids involved. And, you know, we've got a group of our kids that have been playing club sports for a really long time, and that's working for them because their families can afford it. And then we've got a substantial number of kids that they're not participating because of access, not because of interest.
I love that so much. I think the line I'm going to walk away with from this interview is they didn't wake up one day wanting to play basketball. They've always wanted to play, and it's our job to give that to them. I think that that's really special, and I appreciate you saying that. And it's such a lovely high, Adam, after some like somewhat deep moments. So I'm going to kind of wrap us up with our five questions that we ask every guest on our show. And I really appreciate it. This has been an amazing conversation. The things that you're doing with community is so inspiring. And I really appreciate you sharing everything with us. The first question that we ask everyone is, everyone here is more than a test and thinks of something different. For Amira, it's because, you know, just like you talked about an assessment, we believe that assessments can be every day and based on a child's voice reading. But every superintendent we posted, every guest we've had, has thought it meant something else. When you heard more than a test, what did it mean for you?
When I heard more than a test, what it meant to me is that kids' school experience is holistic. It's more than just about learning. It's about relationships. It's about citizenship. It's about learning to care about and invest in your community. It's about learning to contribute. It's about understanding yourself in spaces and being aware. So that's where my mind went to is, yeah, this is way bigger than just learning.
That's great. And I think that might as well be like your theme in life. It seems like you're all about the whole child and holistic, what everyone needs. Okay, since we're a reading company, we ask you to share one lit moment. And what we mean by your lit moment is a moment of you in a book that either changed you or is your happy place or something that a time where you were with a book that is really an important part of your life.
Yeah, well, a couple come to mind that's hard. One is just, I was a high school English teacher. And so I just loved teaching literature to kids. I just being able to talk with freshmen and sophomores about what does this mean to you? What does it mean to the world? What did it mean to this author? So that definitely comes first and foremost. And then my favorite leadership book is a book called Leadership and Self-Deception. And it's a small, it's a quick read, but really captures a lot of the essence of what I believe about leadership and humanity. So that, comes to mind.
I've read a lot of leadership and I haven't heard of it, so I'm going to look it up. What was your favorite book to teach as an English teacher?
Oh.
Everyone says To Kill a Mockingbird. You can say To Kill a Mockingbird, but.
Yeah. I appreciate the challenge of teaching that text to kids, just the complexity of the intersectionality of some of the cultural things that that are prevalent. I really like teaching Julius Caesar, just because there was just lots of fun things you could do with it and the way we'd act it out. And for a lot of kids, it was kind of, you know, their first kind of taste of that type of literature and watching them kind of grapple with the text and what does it mean? Why is this important? And also just the historical relevance of, are we really reading something that is this old, you know, all the things that high schoolers kind of are processing through, yeah, which are kind of their own off ramps to, I think, really valuable conversations that maybe don't even directly have to do with the story. So,
yeah, that's great. A piece of technology that you love.
Oh, piece of technology, noise canceling AirPods.
Oh my gosh.
Noise canceling AirPods.
That's awesome. The best advice you've ever been given.
This too shall pass.
And one book you think everyone should read?
Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here today. I appreciate that. As someone who is constantly turning the dial on my life too, it's nice to have someone that, like a comrade in arms, and I really appreciate it. So have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks for joining us on the More Than a Test podcast. If you found this conversation valuable, subscribe to our YouTube channel and find us on your favorite podcast platform. At Amira Learning, we believe every child deserves a chance to become a reader, and we're excited to be part of this conversation. See you next week, and thanks for joining.